Welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, broadcasting shows from radio's past. I'm your host, Mark Livonier. In this hour, True History. Later on, it's You Are There from 1948. But first, one of the more forward-thinking shows from radio's yesteryear, and that's the civil rights-themed program New World A-Coming. Based out of WMCA in New York in the 1940s, and was based on the book written by Roy Ottley, who was America's best-known African-American journalist at the time. This episode called The Mammy Legend, from June 18, 1944.
With the sweep and fury of the resurrection, there's a new world a-coming. Today and every Sunday at this hour, WMCA, in cooperation with the Citywide Citizens Committee on Harlem, brings you a series of vivid programs dramatizing the inner meaning of Negro life, based on the prize-winning bestseller, New World A-Coming by Roy Ottley, featuring Georgette Harvey, well-known character actress and star of the stage and radio, Eric Roberts, recently featured in the motion pictures Watch on the Rhine and North Star, and as narrator, one of the outstanding actors in America, Canada Lee.
If there's one thing that irritates Negroes today, it is the mammy legend, often romanticized in song and story. Yes, of course, the mammy did exist once. For at least two centuries, she was an institution of the Old South. Even now, here and there, one can be found. But today, the Old South as we knew it is disappearing, and mammy is rapidly passing away with it. Today, Mammy has become largely a fiction, a museum piece of slavery days. Yes, it's true that Mammy, the epitome of the patient, contented slave, doesn't live here anymore. Yet you'll still hear some people saying,
"Why, old Sarah, she's really one of us. She thinks more of us, almost, than we do of ourselves."
Why, sir, we cherish Julia. She's a black diamond. Been in our family for many years. And can she cook? Why, someday they'll need a waffle maker in heaven and we'll lose her.
The old dear. There isn't a thing she wouldn't do for me. And the best of it is that no matter what or how much she does, she never seems to get sick.
While such people exalt Mammy verbally, they often don't seem to understand that she has developed strong feelings about her role as a servant, about her own identity, and particularly about her own race. It is this development that has lately caused conflicts between Negro servants and their white employers. Well, take, for example, the experiences of a Negro domestic in the home of Mr. and Mrs. Frederick Milburn. Her name is Martha Howard.
"Yes, I'm Martha Howard. I worked for the Milburns for 10 years, ever since Junior was born. The Milburns were like most folks, nice people. And Junior, I watched him grow up just like my own boy, who is now in the Army. I like little Junior, and I think he liked me. He was a good boy, bright, quick, smart as most children are, well-behaved. A little gentleman. In all fairness, if you ask the Milburns, I think they would say that I did my work well. I was called on to do all sorts of things, like, for instance, whenever Junior was sick, I would be the one to look after him."
"Good morning, Martha."
"Well, good morning, Junior. How are you feeling, son?"
"Oh, I feel fine."
"Well, now let me put these shades up and see." "Yes, you do look better. I guess you'll be ready to get up tomorrow.
Tomorrow? Not today?
Another day in bed, son, and your cold will be gone completely.
Okay, if you say so. Is Mother up yet?
Yes, she just had her breakfast. She'll be in a minute. Here now. Let me fix that pillow back in your head.
Good morning, son.
Good morning, Mother. Martha says I'll be all right by tomorrow.
Yes, ma'am. You're getting along fine.
Well, I think by tomorrow you'll be well enough to go back to school. Oh, Martha, I don't know what we'd do without you. Did you get enough sleep last night?
Oh, yes, ma'am. I only got up twice during the night to get him some water.
Well, if you're not too tired, you'd better go out and do the shopping now. I'll stay here with you.
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, Martha, we're having special friends come in to dinner for tomorrow night. I'd like everything to be just right. Richards are coming for dinner and bridge.
Mm, yes, ma'am. I'll do my best. Oh, I remember that Mr. Richards likes apple pie.
Yes, he does. And, oh, Martha, don't forget to give the house an extra special cleaning today. Dust the bookshelves and wash the woodwork and vacuum clean all the rugs. And, oh, Martha, make sure you polish the silver.
Now, that day was pretty much like any other. Days got so that one just ran into another. Washing, cooking, shopping, doing around the house. The next day didn't seem any different, except for one thing. I was in the kitchen working, thinking, when Junior came in. At first, I didn't hear him.
Martha! 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 What are you thinking about?
Oh, Junior, I was just lost in thought.
About what, Martha?
Oh, I got a letter this morning from my boy, Charlie.
Charlie? In the army?
Yes, he's coming here tonight. He's got a furlough.
Where's he been fighting?
Well, now, he hasn't been fighting yet. He's just finishing his basic training. But I guess he'll be going overseas most any day now.
Where is he going, Martha?
Well, child, I'm sure he don't know that himself.
Gosh, I wish I could be a soldier.
Good Lord, this war will be over long before that, I hope. That's one reason why Charlie's in a uniform. So you won't have to go when you go up.
I wish I could see him. Is he an officer?
No, Junior, he's only a private.
Will I be awake when he comes here?
I don't know. Depends on what time his train gets in.
I'd like to see him, even if he gets here when I'm sleeping.
Well, we'll have to ask your mother about that. You know, you've got to get up in time for school in the morning.
I'll ask Mom right away. I'm going to join the Air Corps when I grow up. I'm going to get in an airplane. I'm going to go, all the Nazis and Japs in the sky. I'll dive right into them. I'll zoom up and then I'll circle around. I'll get every one of them.
Yes, I believe you would. And get a chest full of medals, too. Your poor mother. I hope she's spared the things I go through each time I think of something happening to Charlie. All right, now, you go on and let me finish my work. I got to get this dinner ready on time for your mother's friends. He sure was a bright little fellow, and always knew what was going on. And what he didn't know, he tried to find out. Well, that night, Mr. and Mrs. Richards from up the street came to dinner. Everything had gone on smoothly. And when they got to the dessert, the apple pie, Mr. Richards was feeling fine.
Oh, by golly, Billy, that was certainly a fine piece of pie.
Did you really like it, John?
I like it? Why, that's the best pie I've had in years. That cook of yours is sure wonderful.
I guess we're pretty lucky that we still have Martha.
We've got a girl like her, too.
Mm. Really, Diana?
Why, you've never in your life tasted fried chicken like she makes it. We wouldn't part with her for the world.
Well, I don't blame you. The way things are, it's terribly hard to find good servants these days.
Yes, the war industries gobble them all up. You never know when they'll skip off.
But, Frederick, we don't have to worry about that. Martha's happy here with us. And Junior loves her almost as much as he does me.
Well, if he does, it's because he sees more of her than he does of you, darling.
Oh, Frederick.
Well, I think you're spoiled, Father, really. Well, now, who in the world could that be? Are you expecting anyone else this evening?
Oh, my goodness. Yes, I forgot all about it.
Well, who is it?
Martha's son, Charlie, the one who's in the army. He got a furlough and wrote her that he was coming here tonight to see her.
Mother! 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 Guess who's here? Guess who's here?
Junior, what are you so excited about?
Charlie's here, Mother, in a uniform and everything.
Hush, darling. Lower your voice. There's no need to shout.
Yes, Mother. And you know what, Daddy?
What, Junior?
He's got wings on his sleeve. He's in the Air Corps.
Well, that's fine.
Why, Junior, do you think you'll be able to sleep tonight with all this excitement?
I guess Junior wouldn't mind being in the Air Corps himself. Now, would you, Junior, huh?
Who, me? Yes, sir. I want to be a pilot when I'm old enough.
Frederick,
I think it would be nice if we invited Martha and her son into the living room while we're having our coffee. I think it would be a nice thing to do, don't you?
Well, darling.
I'll ask them to come in, Mother. I'll bring them in.
June Jr.
Yes, Dad?
Well, never mind. Go ahead.
Okay, Dad.
Well, I guess that sort of breaks up our bridge game for this evening.
Frederick, I don't think so.
I'm sorry, John.
Oh, that's all right. Forget about it.
Of course. Besides, I don't see how you could get out of it with Junior being so persistent.
Well, shall we go into the living room?
Sure. We don't mind not playing.
Charles, would you like another cup of coffee?
Oh, no, thank you, Mrs. Milburn.
So you're in the Air Corps, eh, Charles?
Yes, ma'am. And I've just been accepted for further training at the flying school.
Boy, that's swell, isn't it, Dad?
You mean the ground crew, don't you?
Oh, why, no, sir. The pilot, sir.
Well, aren't the qualifications pretty stiff?
Yes, sir, but I just made it. I was very lucky that I'd completed 2 years of college before I went into the service. That helped plenty, I'll tell you.
Well, that's fine.
Mother, one of the boys in our school, one of the older boys...
Junior, your father's talking. It isn't polite to interrupt.
I'm sorry, but Mother, the Air Corps wants lots of boys.
Well, Charlie, I guess you're learning a whole lot in the Army. Negroes are getting opportunities for the first time, I hear.
Yes, sir, they are.
Well, you seem to be doing well. I hope you'll make the most of your opportunities. I suppose your people have their own training grounds and divisions.
Well, sir, well, that's just one thing about the Army that none of us likes. Especially when they say that this is a war for democracy. That kind of treatment, Negro this and white that. It doesn't seem fair to us, but, well, I guess that'll all be reckoned with in the future.
How do you mean that, Charles?
Well, Miss Milburn, you see, when you're in the Army and you fight for something, you fight for something that's right. That's the reason why I think we're fighting this war, for things that are right. Everybody in a uniform takes a chance on giving up his life. Negro soldiers are not different. We believe we're fighting for something that's right, and we don't think we ought to be separated on any count.
I see what you mean, Charles.
I think there's some headway being made, too.
Yes, Charles. Go on.
Well, you see, in a few months, if I make the grade, I'll be in a flyer's uniform. That's a little headway, I think. There were no Negro flyers in the last war.
Gosh, Charlie, I wish I were flying with you.
Now, Junior, you know you can't do that.
Why, Mrs. Richards?
Well, it's just not done, that's all.
I think, Junior, what Mrs. Richards means is that you're not old enough to be in the uniform. Only boys who are in the Army can fly Army planes.
Well, gosh, I hope when I'm old enough to get in the Army, they'll let me fly with Charlie.
Well, perhaps someday. Martha, you've been quiet all evening. You've hardly said a word.
I'm just so glad to see Charlie. I guess there's just nothing to say.
Junior, I think you ought to go to bed now, don't you? Past your bedtime.
Must I go so early, Dad?
Well, yes, Junior, I think so.
Well, come on, boy. Take you upstairs.
Okay, Martha.
And Charlie.
Yes, Ma.
You can wait for me in my room.
Okay.
I'll be down in a little while.
Charles, you must come and see us
again
before you go away.
Thank you very much.
Good night, Charles.
Good
night,
Charles.
Good night,
I took young Junior upstairs and put him to bed. Opened the windows, pulled the shades down, said goodnight to him. Closed the door softly behind me and started down the stairs toward my room. On the way down, I heard Mrs. Richards talking loudly. What she was saying gave me a start.
Well, my dear, your son certainly seemed interested in your cook son.
Oh, that's quite natural. All young boys idolize soldiers in uniform.
Yes. But he doesn't seem to realize that your cook's son is a Negro.
Diana, I don't think there's anything to fear in that. Martha's a Negro, but she's also an American woman and the mother of a very intelligent boy who'd be a credit to any parent.
Well, I wouldn't encourage that kind of relationship in my home.
Oh, come now, dear. What difference does it make? Well, come on, let's play some bridge, huh? What do you say, Fred?
All right, I'll get the cards and score.
I was hurt by what Mrs. Richards had said. I guess it was more than that. I was stunned. In the 10 years that I had been working in her home, this was the first time that I ever heard any talk about color. I walked into my room and found my boy waiting for me. My own boy. In uniform. He noticed at once that something was wrong, but I got around that all right. I didn't let on what I had heard that night. Charlie slept in my mother's home. And we arranged to see each other sometime during the next day. I guess I would have forgotten the whole thing if next morning when I went upstairs, I happened to pass Junior's room and heard Mr. Milburn talking to Junior. I've always known that Mr. Milburn was concerned with what neighbors said and thought, but I never dreamed that he would take so seriously what Mr. Richards had said the night before.
Now, Junior, naturally, we are very fond of Charlie, but he... Well, he's not like us, you know.
I know, Dad. Perhaps not. Maybe we're all a little different, but they say everybody should get a chance in democracy. We talked about it in school.
Oh, well, that's not exactly what I mean. It's just this. Well, your skin is white, whereas Charlie's is dark.
Does that make any difference?
Well, does it?
Well, does it?
Well, Junior, it means that Charles is, he's a very nice person, but, well, he's not white, and therefore not in the same class.
You mean because his skin is a different color?
Yes, Junior.
Dad, are you sure?
Well, certainly I'm sure. Color makes a lot of difference.
Gee, it just doesn't make sense.
Well, let me put it this way, son. How would you like it if I took Martha to the movies tonight?
What's playing?
Now, what difference does that make? If I took a Negro to the movies, we would be ostracized by polite society. Nobody would play with you anymore.
Do you really think so, Dad?
Well, yes, I think so. People would say I had a son who was being brought up wrong.
Is there any law which says people with dark skins are not equal to people with white skins?
It's practically a law.
Yes, but it isn't really a law, is it?
Well, Junior, I'm not going to argue with you. I want you to understand what I've said to you. Do you understand?
No, Dad.
When they came out of the room, I lowered my head so our eyes wouldn't meet and walked past them. Junior said,
"Hello, Martha."
I don't know whether I answered him or not. I knew there was only one thing to do. I tried to calm myself, keep my head about me, but it was no use. My head was spinning like a top. The whole thing happened so sudden, I couldn't believe it. When I got to my room, I packed up my things and then walked into Ms. Milburn's room. She was talking on the phone.
Why, of course, King. We'd love to have you and Bill come for dinner. Oh, think nothing of it. Just a minute, dear. Someone came into the room. Oh, what is it, Martha?
I'll wait, Ms. Milburn, till you're finished.
Why, Martha, you look so... What's happened?
I'm leaving, Miss Milburn.
Leaving?
I can't work in this house a minute longer.
What? Oh, my goodness, this is terrible. What's come over you, Martha?
Nothing, except I'm leaving, Miss Milburn.
Wait just a minute. Jean, darling, I'll call you back in a few minutes. No, it's all right. Yes, in a very few minutes. Now, Martha, what's all this about?
Something I can't repeat. I don't want to talk about it. I came to get my money for a week's work. I just can't work here no more.
Martha, you just can't leave this way after 10 years. What's happened? Whatever it is, I'll straighten it out.
I'm afraid you can't straighten this out, Mrs. Milburn.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Ask Mr. Milburn. He can tell you. Or talk to your son. Junior will tell you.
Wait a second. Frederick?
Yes, Millicent.
Come up here, please.
All right, I'm coming. Well, what's up, Millicent?
Frederick, what did you say to Martha?
Martha?
Martha says she's leaving.
Leaving? Well, why?
I worked to use for 10 years, to the day, and never got too much pay. I came here in the Depression because I couldn't do no better. I stayed on, did my work, and you all seemed to like me.
Why, we do, Martha, we do. We're very fond of you.
Working here, I couldn't look after my own son, life. I gave you most of my time, day and night. Whenever you asked me to do extra things like that dinner last night, and even when you didn't ask me, I wasn't in love with the work. But I tried to do a good day's work and not complain.
And we're perfectly satisfied with you, Martha.
I always liked your boy. He's a good boy. I treated him like I did my own.
And he loves you too, Martha.
But after just what I heard Mr. Milburn tell your boy, I don't belong here.
You...
You heard what I told you, Ernest?
Only by accident. I was coming up the stairs. The door was open anyway. I'm glad to know how you feel.
What did you tell Junior Frederick?
You had nothing against me, Mr. Milburn. But the things you told your son only helped to turn his mind against me and my race. People who've done nothing wrong to you.
I only tried to show him to try to explain to him. Well, you know, Mark.
Yes, I know, Mr. Milburn. And I'm sorry for you because you're teaching your own flesh and blood to have prejudice.
Martha, I wish you'd reconsider what you're doing. I'm sure Mr. Milburn meant no harm. But where will you go if you leave here?
Oh, I don't need to worry about that. Plenty of places for me to go.
Well, I wish you wouldn't do anything hasty. Why don't you take the rest of the day off, Martha? Think it over before you make any decisions.
I couldn't have any respect for myself if I didn't do just what I'm doing now.
Then you've definitely made up your mind about leaving.
Yes.
Well, while you say goodbye to Junior, I'll make out your check.
No, Miss Milburn. I'd rather not see him now.
Why, he'll feel terrible when he learns that you've gone without saying goodbye.
Some other time, maybe. But I don't want to interfere with what his father said.
I'm terribly sorry, Martha.
I never really explained to Charlie why I left the Milburn. I figured he was in the army. And soon enough, he'd be over there fighting for the things we believed in. I didn't want him to get bitter because he had enough to worry about right now. I think he must have known, though, that something was wrong. You can't fool bright young people. And even if I must say it myself, Charlie is a bright boy. I told him that I wanted a job in the war plant, that I wanted to be part of this war, too. And as a matter of fact, about a week later, I got a job in a parachute factory, sewing parachutes. Then one afternoon, it was Sunday after church, I came home to my newly rented house and, well, who do you think was sitting on my doorstep?
Hello, Martha.
Why, Junior, bless your heart. Did you come way up here to see me?
Yes, Martha, I did.
Does your mother know you're here?
Yes, she does, and Father does, too.
Your father?
Dad took back what he said.
And your mother, what did she say?
Mother felt very bad. I think they both did. Gee, Mother hasn't been able to get anyone in the house to stay with us.
Maybe because it's such hard work being a servant. Awfully hard sometimes. Now, since I got my job in the parachute factory, I get more time for myself. And I make more money, too. Isn't that good?
It sure is. I'm glad for you. Martha, you look so nice in that blue dress.
You like it, Junior?
I sure do.
Well, come on inside and let me show you my own house.
May I?
Sure. In my house, friends are always welcome.
New World A-Coming is written by Roy Otley and is based on Mr. Otley's book by the same name. The program is produced and directed by Mitchell Grayson. John Belasco assisted. Original music by James Lozito was conducted by Bill Wurges. The theme song was composed by Duke Ellington.
New World A-Coming, on Tuned to Yesterday from June 18, 1944. And it was in that year that the show won radio's most prestigious award, a Peabody, for its work out of WMCA in New York. This is an hour of true history, on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Straight ahead, it's the You Are There series, where CBS radio reporters seemingly go back in time to report on events of the past. This episode called The Fall of Troy. Now, although that event is full of myth as well, this is an interesting broadcast covering the events of 1184 BC. This was first heard on CBS on October 24th, 1948.
This is Don Hollenbeck in the walled city of Troy. The following is an unofficial and unconfirmed report this ninth morning of the 40th year of the reign of King Priam and the 10th year of the war. A towering figure of a horse at the wall of Troy, Homer's Troy, history's Troy, the Troy of mingled fact and fancy, the epic moment when a proud but decadent civilization faced its destiny on the shores of the Aegean Sea. All things are as they were then, except for one thing.
You are there.
And now,
1184 BC, Inside the Walls of Troy with John Hollenbeck.
The Greek forces have left the Trojan shore. The scouting party is even now somewhere on the plain outside Troy, trying to find out exactly what the Greeks are up to this time. John Daly is with that force, and we're awaiting word from him. We expect to have a report at any moment, and we'll stay on the air until we get that report. Quincy Howe has been assessing the implications and possibilities of the Greek evacuation, and he'll bring us up to date now.
Is this the day for which Troy's national heroes and great warriors, led by Hector, have fought so valiantly and died? If it is, then the intolerable tension of the 10-year siege has ended. No longer will Trojans have to live behind their 30-foot wall, never venturing outside except at the risk of their lives. But there's a big if. Have the Greeks really gone for good? Or is this just another trick in the 10-year history of Greek treachery and deception? Remember that only 3 days ago in the last battle, Troy almost fell to Agamemnon, supreme commander of the Greek allied forces. It was another Greek trick, engineered by their chief strategist, the foxy Odysseus, who showed the Trojans something never seen before in war, something that might be called an armored force. Formations of Greeks, covered top, front, and sides with their shields, advanced to the very walls of Troy. Swords, spears, and arrows bounced off this armored monster until the last minute when Aeneas, the Trojan commander, son-in-law of King Priam, ordered a concentrated rain of heavy rock. The big question now is, if the Greeks have gone, and it's not yet official that they have, we just don't know, the big question is, why, after this long, bitter attempt to overcome Troy, why have they suddenly quit? Have they... Just a moment. John Daly, who's with the scouting party out on the plain, is calling in by short wave.
The report that the Greeks have gone is true. The Greeks have gone. Not one of the 1,165 ships whose mast Troy has seen every morning for 10 years is here. The camps are deserted. Only abandoned barracks, rubbish, smoldering fires, which apparently the Greeks set to destroy their equipment, remain. I can't describe what it feels like to stand out on this plain before Troy without fear of a Greek arrow. However, one very curious thing about this whole mystery is the strange reminder which the Greeks have left behind, a towering image of a horse. It stands 20 feet away, as close as the soldiers will permit me to go. We have to look up to see its head in the early morning light. It's taller, much taller than the 30-foot walls of Troy. Evidently, it's made of highly polished wood, intricately carved, and certainly a master craftsman must have designed and built this imposing and somewhat frightening figure, now all alone on this plain of Troy where for so many years live horses and men with them have died. The Trojan scouting party I'm with is waiting for the arrival of King Priam's advisors. The trolls are scouring the hills and woods surrounding the plain, making sure there will be no ambush, although there seems little likelihood of that since the ships are gone. A group of chariots has come out of Troy. Here come the king's advisors. Yes, I can recognize the chariot of Aeneas, the tight-lipped commander-in-chief of all Trojan forces since the recent death of Hector. And there's the chariot of Thymoetes, suave personal advisor of the king, and, oh yes, the other one, the outer statesman of the king's cabinet and self-appointed guardian of Troy's spiritual welfare is here too. Their chariots are pulling up nearby. The captain of this scouting party has met them and is the king's advisor. Walk towards the monster figure of the wooden horse. The captain is rapidly explaining the sequence of events this morning. Aeneas, Thymoetes, Laocoon are looking at the horse curiously. Aeneas seems puzzled. He keeps staring fixedly at the horse. Thymoetes is smiling urbanely. Only Laocoon is shaking his head angrily and scowling, a mark of the old gentleman's crusty temper. Laocoon has just grabbed a spear from one of the soldiers. He's thrown it right into the horse. The spear is quivering in the flank. It made a sharp, hollow sound. The sun, now breaking through the early morning mist, has caught the spear and is dancing along its shaft. The sun also lights up the horse, and we see now that it has a golden bridle and reins with bridle ornaments in ivory dyed purple. The eyes of the horse are so realistically carved, they seem to be staring watchfully at the walls of Troy 3 miles away. Aeneas, Laocoon, and Thymoetes are talking heatedly now. There seems to be some disagreement, to put it mildly. Thymoetes and Aeneas are practically dragging the old man away from the wooden horse. Thymoetes is pointing in the direction of an abandoned Greek shelter right near here. They're coming this way now, apparently planning to talk things over inside that shelter. Aeneas is in the lead. Aeneas! Aeneas, sir! As commander-in-chief of the Trojan forces, what do you make of all this?
I have nothing to say. Let me pass, please.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Laocoon! Laocoon! Sir, do you feel that the
president... We are being tricked. The Greeks have not gone, please. That's what I thought they would wish us to think. We have not seen the last of them.
We have.
Simeon, you must realize this is a trick. You've got
to
realize.
Now, please, Laocoon, we all know your solicitude for the good of Troy, but Aeneas and I...
Aeneas and you. Burn the image, I say.
Please, sir, please.
Fill it full of spears. And I'll tell the king so, too.
Laocoon, we're keeping our commander in chief waiting.
It's a cunning
thank
clever
you, gentlemen. Simetes and Laocoon are entering the Greek shelter. There certainly seems to be a division of opinion as to the exact meaning of what's going on. Laocoon seems to mistrust the whole business, particularly this big wooden horse here. I believe if he had another spear, he'd throw it into the horse himself. Simetes, however, seems inclined to accept the evidence that the Greeks are gone, and as for Aeneas, the Trojan commander-in-chief, he, as usual, is noncommittal. We'll wait here until their conference is over. A patrol has just come up. They've got a prisoner, a Greek. They're hustling up to the captain, who is standing right here. I can see the Greek now. Two husky soldiers have his arms pinned behind his back. He's a short man, blonde, as all Greeks are, unshaven. Young fellow, his tunic is torn and dirty.
Over every foot of the Greek camp. He wasn't in the camp. We found him in a clump of trees, moving around while we were searching.
Well, you better go out there and see there aren't any more.
Take the prisoner inside.
The captain isn't wasting any time questioning this Greek prisoner.
Right.
He's taking him right into the shelter where Aeneas, Simetes, and Laocoon are conferring. The patrol is fanning out again, going back to see if there are any more Greeks that may have been overlooked. Perhaps the capture of this Greek prisoner will prove to be the key to the mystery of the Greek evacuation. We'll have to wait for something official on this, but here's a message. Richard Hotlet with another Trojan detachment has reached the main Greek camp. He's ready with a report. Go ahead, Hotlet.
It gives one the strangest feeling to stand in this great deserted camp. For 10 years, this has been the Greek arsenal for the siege of Troy. It's not a camp, it's a city, a neighboring city to Troy, about which Trojans have known almost nothing until today. Apparently, the Greeks tried to burn it down, but the fires were not very extensive. If the Greeks really meant to destroy this city camp, they didn't do very well. I'm standing in the huge main square, which evidently served as the meeting place for the Greeks. Streets run into this vast area from all directions. They're silent streets now, but once they were thronged with military, slaves, animals, and women. Captive women picked up on islands in the Aegean and brought by the Greeks to serve them. The air is full of the smell of wild ginger, which grows in abundance on this coastal plain. Trojan women have been deprived of this source of perfume for 10 years, but now they'll have it again. All around the square are the houses formerly occupied by Nestor, Achilles, and Agamemnon, Ajax, all the other Greek leaders. Attached to Achilles' house are barns and stables for supplies, chariot horses, and cattle. This camp, by the way, is right by the edge of the sea. The surf rolls in and the gulls are crying as they hover over the stone foundations which served as land bases for the Greek ships. The ships were lined up in rows facing Troy, and in front of them the Greeks threw up a high earthen wall with a moat. With a moat and watchtowers, but now I've just received word that Aeneas, Primetes, and Laocoon, the king's advisors, have taken the mysterious Greek prisoner to King Priam's palace. John Daly is with them, so over to John Daly.
I'm in an anteroom of King Priam's palace. The Greek prisoner was rushed here almost immediately after being questioned briefly on the Trojan plain. He has just been interrogated thoroughly by the king and his advisors, who are at this moment in conference. We've been given permission to interview the prisoner. He's here with me now under close guard. Guards are walking up and down. The prisoner has given his name as Sinon. It's a name that we don't recognize as being on the lists of Greek warriors and heroes. Now, Sinon, what did you tell the king? Have the Greeks left for good?
I wouldn't have that information. I'm just a minor officer.
I see. Why were you left behind?
I hid myself before the fleet left.
Why?
It's a long story.
Well, we've got plenty of time. Tell it to us.
Well, there's Odysseus. You've probably heard of him.
Yes, I've heard of him, but let's get that long story started.
I had a little trouble with him. There was a disagreement. Something went wrong, and I was blamed.
Well, go on.
Well, People whom Odysseus dislikes have been known to disappear, or they've been found with a dagger in their backs. Yes? I thought I'd disappear without Odysseus' help.
Why did the Greeks leave?
I don't know. I'm just a minor officer.
You must have some idea.
It was said around the camp that we were going back to Greece for fresh supplies.
Then the Greeks are coming back.
It was said around the camp that once our commanders returned home, they'd remain there.
What's the story about the wooden horse?
It was built for the goddess Athene.
Well, why? What for?
The oracles told our commanders that if they built a wooden horse, they'd have victory.
If that's true, why did they leave the horse behind?
It was too big to carry on a ship.
Why not destroy it? Why leave it for the Trojans if it's an offering for victory?
They didn't leave it for the Trojans.
What do you mean?
They built it so big, it can't be taken into the city.
I see. What did the king say to you when... Oh, just a minute. I'm told that the conference between King Priam and his advisors has broken up. Ned Kalmer is in the king's quarters, so over to him.
Thymoetes, Laocoon, and Aeneas are just coming out of the king's cedar-lined suite. Aeneas, sir. What did the king say?
I have nothing to say. Nothing to say.
Laocoon, if you please, sir, what did the king say? Is the war over? I say, Laocoon, sir. Is the war over? What did the king say?
I say the war is not over. I say the Greeks are coming back.
But the king said,
we must not demobilize. We must not relax for an instant. If we do, we are lost.
Yes, I know, sir. But what does the king say? What does he think about the Greek prisoner, about the horse?
He is not sure yet. He will not make a decision yet.
But this means
I begged him to keep the city alert. That horse is a gift from the Greeks. And a Greek gift means death.
Of course, sir.
We must be alert. I say alert. I am going to the temple to pray for cause.
Laocoon, sir.
Thymoetes, sir, what is your view about all this?
Well, it's very simple. As you heard, Laocoon, in his praiseworthy zeal for Troy, argues that the Greeks are coming back. As for my part, I accept the evidence of my eyes and ears. I don't believe everything the Greek prisoner says, but I think we can safely assume that his commanders have had enough of their unsuccessful siege of Troy.
Then the war is officially over.
Not quite. As Laocoon said, the king has been unable to reach a final decision. He's still weighing an official declaration concerning the state of hostility.
Well, then there are no plans for demobilization?
Not immediately.
And what about the wooden horse?
Oh, that's really not important. I can't imagine why the Greeks did it, but we must admit it's a curiosity, a clever product of the woodworker's art. The king agreed that it might provide a welcome spectacle for the people. Every Trojan loves horses. We're bringing it into the city.
But how can you do that, sir? I understood the Greeks had built the wooden horse so big that it couldn't be brought into the city.
Oh, I'm afraid the Greeks were too clever this time. We're simply going to widen the gate.
Oh. Thank you, Thymoetes.
Not at all.
To this reporter, at least, the situation is still rather confused. We don't know yet whether it's war or peace. However, there is in Troy at this time one Greek other than the captive Sinon. For a comment on this baffling situation, that other Greek is now waiting at a microphone with Ken Roberts. So, over to Ken Roberts.
I'm speaking to you from the women's quarters of King Priam's palace. Seated beside me is a beautiful woman. She is dressed in a long, frilled robe with a high, close bodice. At her shoulder, she wears a pin of Chinese jade. The air is scented with her perfume of rose oil. Her hair is blonde and elaborately coiffed. There can be only one such woman, the Princess Helen, formerly of Greece, lately of Troy.
Permanently of Troy now, I hope.
Does that mean then, Princess Helen, that you think your countrymen have finally given up their avowed purpose, never to return to Greece without you?
Now, do you really think my countrymen, as you call them, came all the way to Troy to fight the greatest war of history just for me?
Well, certainly your husband, Menelaus of Sparta, his brother, Agamemnon, and all the Greek commanders have been most vociferous in keeping alive the story that you are the cause of this war.
That is romantic, isn't it? Helen elopes with Paris, Trojan prince. He takes her to Troy. Deserted husband rallies all of Greece, launches 1,000 ships, all to bring back a pretty face. Romantic, yes. In fact, idyllic. But in truth, rather foolish. Let's recognize it for what it really is, a convenient pretext on which to start the war.
Well, Trojans have never heard your version of what this war is all about.
I think it's quite simple. It's a matter of economics and rivalry between two powers. The Greeks are a virile, expanding people. They've outgrown their rocky, unproductive home. They need and want control of the Hellespont, the gateway to the inland sea and the riches of the East. One power stands in their way. Troy. Need I say more?
Sounds reasonable. Do you think that their leaving means that they've finally given up their dream of world conquest?
I wouldn't care to predict what a Greek will do, but I sincerely hope they're not coming back. I don't ever wish to leave Troy. I followed my heart to Troy. Troy is my home. The more so since my Paris died defending it.
Thank you, Princess Helen. This is Ken Roberts. I return you to our studio.
This is Quincy Howe. Priam has not yet decided whether to declare hostilities officially at an end. The old king is a tired, almost broken man who has lost all but one of his sons in this war. Now, this present lack of leadership, this indecision, is doing Troy no good. It has complicated an already confused situation. If Laocoon, Troy's elder statesman, is right, and the city needs more alertness than ever, then every added moment of hesitation weakens morale. A growing body of public opinion, led by Thymoetes, argues that this is indeed the end of the war, the time to demobilize, to cut wartime taxes, to lift controls and trade restrictions inside and outside Troy. All this eagerness for peace comes out in the reception given the wooden horse, which is now inside the city. Many Trojans agree with Thymoetes that it's a victory trophy, and these people are trying to persuade others to share that view. Yet even while Laocoon prays in the temple, another prominent citizen is carrying a message of warning to the Trojan people. She is King Priam's daughter, Princess Cassandra, the strong-willed, social-minded reformer. At this moment, Princess Cassandra is in the main market square addressing the public. John Daly's there, too, so over to John Daly.
A big crowd growing every minute. It seems as if every citizen of Troy is coming into this market square carrying torches. The people are listening quietly, intently. They seem unable to make up their minds. Let's listen.
For years, this man has been saying, appease the Greeks, end the war at all costs, make peace with the Greeks, give them what they want, lie down and grovel before them on their path to world conquest. Who was it who counted us who stepped to Greek ultimatum before the war began? It was Thymoetes. Who was it, once the war began, who begged to accept the terms of Odysseus for a dishonorable peace? It was Thymoetes, and I have reason to know that this same Thymoetes has held secret meetings with the Greeks here inside Troy, while your sons and husbands on the plain out there were dying. Citizens of Troy, I tell you, the Greeks are coming back. Now is the time, if ever, for Trojans to double their guard and their vigilance. Now.
This is Don Hollenbeck. We have interrupted the Princess Cassandra to announce the death of Laocoon. The elder statesman died under mysterious circumstances while praying in the temple of Poseidon. His two sons died with him. Authorities are investigating, and in the absence of an official explanation, wild rumors are beginning to circulate. The story is being spread that Laocoon and his sons were strangled by serpents. Other fantastic accounts are going the rounds, but more reliably, it is reported that Laocoon and his sons may have been murdered by unknown elements opposing his violent resistance to the declaration of peace.
We'll bring you further news as it develops, but now back to John Daly in the Market Square.
This is John Daly. The news of the death of Laocoon has already reached this square, and it's having an electrifying effect on this great crowd. Quiet just a few minutes ago, it has now come to life, and the men and women in it are turning to all sorts of celebration. They're taking the death of Laocoon and his sons as a divine visitation, a punishment of the elder statesman for opposing the party of peace. They're milling about the square, pushing and shoving, forming into groups of celebrants. Many of them have suddenly brought out goat skins of wine. Others are headed for the taverns, and they're shouting, "Peace, peace, the war is over." It looks as if the decision has been taken from King Priam's hands, the decision which he was unable to make himself. The citizens of Troy, have declared peace, and the gods help them if the decision is a wrong one. Still, there's no news here in the square as to what Aeneas, the commander... Oh, wait a minute. Ned Kelmer has some news at King Priam's palace. Go ahead, Kelmer.
There are Greek soldiers inside Troy near the wall. Headquarters has just made this statement. Aeneas and Thymoetes have left the palace with a body of troops. They're on their way to the wall. News of the Greek's sudden appearance was brought to the palace by a wounded Trojan soldier. He was with the detachment on guard at the wooden horse. We've been promised more details as soon as possible. Couriers have been sent from the palace to all parts of the city to alert the populace and round up all troops. I repeat, there are Greek soldiers in Troy near the wall. This statement was made a short while ago here at King...
This is Don Hollenbeck. John Daly is on his way with a mobile unit to the wall where the Greek soldiers have been reported seen. Richard Hartlett has taken over in the market square, so for the city's reaction to that news, we'll switch you there. Come in, Richard Hartlett.
As far as we can tell, the reaction down here to the report that there are Greek soldiers in the city seems to be a mixture of disbelief and unconcern. The crowd, which began celebrating the end of the war when Laocoon's death was announced, has grown larger and even more exuberant. More and more soldiers have joined it without their arms. By the light of their moving torches, we can see the soldiers, arm in arm with the civilians, thronging the square and streaming in and out of the taverns around it. This cobbled square is littered with empty wineskins. The one sober, urgent note in all this rejoicing is the presence of the couriers from headquarters trying desperately to round up these celebrating troops for whatever action may be required. Soldier, soldier, wait a minute.
You hurry, I'm not going anywhere.
But aren't you on your way back to barracks? Where's your sword?
What? Well, I need a sword for it. Never going back to the barracks.
But your orders, there's news about Greek soldiers in the city.
Greek soldiers? Where? What? What? I didn't hear it.
There's been a report from the palace that there are Greek soldiers near the wall. Your commander-in-chief ordered all troops on the alert.
Thanks. How's it go to my barracks? The one perhaps I have...
Wait a minute. Aren't you going the wrong direction, soldier? Your barracks are this way.
Well, that's true. Where did I leave my sword? I can't remember.
Ned Kelmer at the palace has more details about the Greeks in the city, so come in, Ned Kelmer.
The Greeks in the city came from the wooden horse, which was hollow. As nearly as the wounded Trojan soldier could estimate, there were about 25 of them, and he thought he recognized Odysseus. In the darkness, the soldier said, the small Trojan detachment, which had been posted as a guard around the horse, was surprised and overcome. Everyone but this soldier killed without a chance of self-defense. The wounded man left for dead, managed, however, to make his way to the palace. He said that when the Greeks had gone, he could see the hole in the belly of the horse through which the Greeks had crawled, and a ladder down which they climbed to the ground. After killing the guards, the Greeks then made off in the direction of the wall. We don't know if this Trojan soldier is going to live or not, and we don't yet know the full implications of this.
This is Don Hollenbeck at News Headquarters. We've interrupted Ned Kelmer because John Daly and a mobile unit has reached the wall. Go ahead, John Daly.
Thousands of Greek soldiers are streaming across the plain from the beaches towards the walls of Troy. The plain is almost as light as day with the fires of Greek torches and beacons. The Greek host is pouring out of the Greek fleet, which has returned to the harbor in full strength. In the distance, these ships are being unloaded. In front of them, vast columns of troops are lining up, and nearer to us, the chariots are moving across the plain, moving closer and closer to the wall of Troy. Waiting for them at the main gate of that wall 30 feet below are not armed Trojans ready to die in bitter defense of their city, but instead Greeks, the small band of Greeks which came out of the belly of the wooden horse, who quickly overpowered the surprised and totally unprepared guard at the main gate, which had been widened to allow for the entrance of this great wooden horse. This
small band is waiting now to march at the head of the oncoming Greek horde into the city. On our way to the wall from the city square, we heard repeatedly the story from civilians and soldiers alike that Aeneas has deserted, has fled the city, and that Thymoetes, the man who had cried, peace, peace, at any price, has taken over command to meet the Greek army, not in combat, but as an ally. There's one story that he's at this very moment with Odysseus at the main gate, and that Sinon, the mysterious prisoner, is with him also. All of which adds up to a picture which is becoming increasingly clear every passing moment as these Greek chariots come nearer and nearer the city gate of Troy, which is now open to receive them. This has been a plot, a cunning stratagem conceived probably by Odysseus and cleverly carried out by Sinon, a plot which was nourished by Troy's fatal moments of indecision and its people's weariness of war and their unwillingness to listen to Laocoon and Cassandra. Now, below me, the first of the Greek chariots have reached the gate. There are some empty ones to accommodate the men from the wooden horse. They are getting into them, passing through the gate. The Greeks are now entering Troy in full force, and so far, not a sign of any Trojan defense. One can imagine how effective that defense will be with all of the city taken off guard, demoralized, and at the height of celebration, rejoicing.
1184 B.C. Troy takes a gift from the Greeks and dies.
The Fall of Troy was broadcast originally by CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System, and came to you at this time as another program in the series You Are There.
You Are There, on Tuned to Yesterday from the 24th of October, 1948 on CBS. And that brings to a close this hour of True History, on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. Thanks for tuning in.